الكورة ماسك كمبيوتر. Okay. Hello, students. So we're still working on this module called Language Acquisition, and I'm so excited today that I'm able to introduce to you Associate Professor Bas Ringdahl. Now, students, the really exciting thing is that you're actually going to read Sandy's paper after watching this video, and it's a really incredibly important paper. So I really hope that you enjoy the discussion now with Sandy. And really have a think about her research and the paper, and then when you go to read the paper, this is really going to be quite critical for your learning in this module. The paper is called The Relationship of Audibility and the Development of Canonical Babble in Young Children with Hearing Impairment. Now, we've been using this paper for quite a number of years now since the paper was first published, and that's because I think it's a really key read for you, and it gives us a real crucial understanding of what needs to be in place for language to develop in deaf children. So, hello, Sandy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. So, it's a really huge honour and privilege for me to meet you here today. So, I was just wondering, for the students at home, to start us off, maybe you could explain something about the background and the background to the work and why you were interested in this study.
Oh, sure. Again, thank you for inviting me, and very humbled that you enjoy my paper. I was really excited about it as well, and that's, you know, why I pursued it. But I guess I became interested in the topic based upon my clinical work. I found myself working along patients at a cochlear implant center, and I noticed that many of the families who came in to meet with us had, I guess you could say, the children had inadequate or not very well documented hearing aid fitting information. So we were seeing a stream of families with limited information regarding goodness of hearing aid fit, how well, you know, does the child's hearing aids meet audibility targets. And so that left me, you know, wondering, you know, we're making, you know, really important decisions with limited information. So that was sort of one of the big things that I noticed. The other piece was, you know, for many of the families, you know, originally that were coming in, as soon as they, you know, learned that, yes, you know, you are a cochlear implant candidate, you know, based upon your degree of loss, the families oftentimes relaxed, and right, yeah, I understand, you know, understood, you know, why they would do that, but they no longer emphasize the need for keeping hearing aids on a child, you know, because, you know, well, the child would receive an implant maybe in, you know, 3 months or 6 months, and so, you know, why go through the trouble of keeping hearing aids on? And so, you know, those two pieces really made me want to explore the topic more. Plus, I was, you know, a doctoral student at the University of Iowa, that was an area that treatment efficacy and treatment decision making was an area I was really interested in. So the two kinds of things came together as a basis for me to get started with this work.
So in terms of this particular paper, this piece of this project, this research, what was it you were trying to find out? What did you want to know?
Well, I wanted to know how audibility, and for your students, you know, as an audiologist, that's my clinical clinical background. We look at something called the Speech Intelligibility Index, and we look at, you know, how much of the speech signal is audible to the child, and we can get those calculations, you know, through a series of measurements made with, you know, real ear verification systems. So I was really interested in, you know, is there a certain amount of audibility from the hearing aid, or, you know, I'll talk about, you know, applying that to the cochlear implant in a moment, but is there a certain amount of audibility that's necessary for a child to develop vocalizations, and in particular that building block of canonical babble, that well-formed syllable? So that was one of the big things that I wanted to find out. And I would say that was one of the major pieces. I made myself a couple of notes, so I had to go back here. The other thing that I wanted to investigate was this idea of hearing age. And it bothered me a bit that, hearing age oftentimes, at least for the purposes that with the families that I worked with, they would just assume that, nothing counts until the implant. Of course we know that the implant provides audibility, but what about everything leading up to it? So I was really interested and hoping to find out if hearing age could be thought about related to audibility and actually, look at pre-implant audibility and how that might impact progress post-implant. And might it have an accelerating impact or, and so what kinds of differences might you see in the children? And I also applied a single subject, investigation, although I'll talk a little bit about some of the limitations related to, like a multiple baseline investigation. But I really wanted to know about hearing age and if hearing age could actually start prior to implantation when a child was wearing a hearing aid. And so yeah. those two pieces were pretty important, I think, that I wanted to find out.
So you just touched on a point there, which I know that our students will be really interested in this. So you just talked about canonical babble, because we talk a lot on our program. We're talking about those early milestones. Why do you think that stage of canonical babble is so important for deaf children?
Well, I think, a mature syllable is a building block to first word production. So, and I'm sure that your students also look at, vocalizations leading up to canonical babble and well-formed syllables, and you have everything from a fully resonant nuclei or, a well-produced vowel sound. And you also get into this stage of marginal canonical production. So a consonant vowel production that, sounds like it could be a true canonical syllable, but in fact, it's not produced with a fully resonant vowel or some other, maybe the format transition between consonant and vowel is drawn out, and so it has qualities of a consonant and a vowel, but it's not like a mature syllable. So that mature syllable is the building block, and so and there's the hallmark of first word production. So so it's important to distinguish between the marginal syllable and that well-formed canonical syllable. So I always think about, that well-formed syllable as being an indicator that first words are not too far off, at least initially when canonical syllable is in a good proportion or quantity of a child's vocalizations. So canonical babble, very, very important. The canonical syllable, mature, well-formed, and understanding the differences related to that marginal production, where it sounds like a syllable, consonant, vowel, but something's not quite right. And as you know, that, marginal syllable production is also, in the trajectory of, typical vocalization production, but it's just, if you're a child with limited hearing, then, you might not move beyond marginal syllable production as you're exploring the vocalizations.
Yeah. So it's just such a really key, important milestone, yeah. Isn't it? And also kind of the way that parents are able to interact with that babble when it sounds so clear in speech like for them, that we have this back and forth situation there with parents, don't we? So what were you hoping to find out, Sandy? What did you think you were going to find out in your study, or what did you find out?
Well, a couple of things. I think I found out that audibility matters. It's important, and what families do prior to the implant matters. Even if the child receives, is a candidate for an implant, and an implant now is really the standard of care I think you would agree it's the standard of care for families who are pursuing oral language.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. So I think that what you do leading up to the implant matters, and in fact, I guess kind of stepping back to another question that you had that adds to what I found is that. You can have two children with an audiogram ABR work that are very, very similar, yet when you look at their vocalization production, it can be very different. And so one of the things that I was hoping to find out is what other variables aside from auditory nerve survival, hair cell survival, because we can't, we've always been told that if two audiograms you'll get, you can get very different performance, mainly because of the survival of or the state of the auditory system. But what other variables might come into play? And I think that this paper showed that a variable that is within our control would certainly be hearing aid use, audibility, even if it's just intonation of speech, some vowel information, and then that tends to allow a child to have a greater quantity of vocalizations leading up to implantation. They're more vocal with hearing aid use. And then using that information, post-implant, it seems to be a bit of a springboard to vocalization development. So, if you have some good things going prior, it's maybe not enough, of course, to develop, oral language, but it serves as a building block. And so I think that, for those children in my study who had, well-fit hearing aids, had audibility, and some of them even produced canonical syllables prior to the implant, their acceleration post-implant was, I think, impressive. Of course, there are other variables, certainly that come into play, intervention, the amount, some other cognitive kinds of things, but I think that was an important finding. The other thing I think that was really interesting is that the course of vocalization development post implant, it follows a very similar pattern as typically hearing children, so that was kind of a really interesting thing to find, that you have you're moving through stages of pre-canonical vocalization and vocal play and all these great sounds, and then you move into canonical syllable production, and then skipping ahead to word production, and that you have a very similar course of vocalization development post-implant. The difference might be that of course for very young children we have a physiological limit on the age at which they can begin canonical syllable production, right? It has to do with the physiology of the vocal tract and orientation of the larynx, et cetera. And so when you receive a cochlear implant, you're usually, and this varies, depending upon where you get the implant, but you're beyond that sort of 6 month chronological age at which you have these, massive changes occurring. So I think that post-implant, you might find an acceleration of canonical syllable production once you get enough audibility, that you don't necessarily need that, 6 months chronological that maybe an infant needs, which is probably a coupling of auditory experience as well as changes in the physiology of the system, if that makes sense. So that it was kind of an interesting thing to find.
And when parents can see that typical trajectory of language, then they're able to interact with that. That's incredibly supportive to parents, isn't it? To kind of continue what they're doing and keep supporting that language development. Yeah. Do you think your study was limited in any way?
I do. I mean, their studies are always have
limits. There's always a limit.
one of the things. So my study design was a multiple baseline if you will, non-concurrent, so naturally occurring multiple baseline, which basically means that, you know, I did not have control over when children received the treatment of a cochlear implant. So that was controlled by the surgeon. And you know, at the time, as much as we could give input related to, you know, what the children's vocalizations were like, we did. But you know as well as I do probably that the surgeon has a lot of decision-making power. And I think some of the research was a bit early too, and sort of, you know, thinking about these factors. So the baseline really was at the discretion of, you know, when the surgeon decided that that the child would receive an implant. So for children who I was able to enroll, you know, much prior to 12 months of age, I was able to get, you know, a nice lengthy, you know, consistent, you know, hearing aid baseline recordings, you know, on a regular basis. For children who came to us at older ages, you know, I worked very hard to try to make sure that, you know, I had at least one, multiple, if possible, recordings. And then, you know, there was one child in particular that comes to mind. He's Axel in my study. And he was a child who came to us. He was a late ID. Everybody was, you know, understandably so concerned about his lack of vocalization development. He had his hearing aid for a very minimal amount of time by his local provider. And the decision was made by the surgeon that, you know, yes, based audiologically, we need to do this. So, you know, he's one that, you know, I wish that we had a longer recording on. So there's that that limitation, you know, that naturally occurring application of treatment. The other thing I think is that, you know, I don't know what would have happened. I think historically we know, but, you know, certainly there were some children with hearing aids who had really well-developed typical canonical babble and, you know, wonderful pre-canonical productions that if you, you know, in a cochlear implant child, you would be, this is great. This, you know, this child's doing everything that's needed. I don't know what would have happened for those children if they would have continued with hearing aids and did not receive the cochlear implant. You know, what would their vocalization development have been? Would they have had enough from the hearing aid to develop, you know, what are, and then also, you know, what are the characteristics of, you know, beyond the well-formed syllable, are there other indicators that would let us know that answer? And, you know, and I think that, I guess you can say that ship has sort of sailed, I guess, in that, you know, we do find very, very good outcomes for children who are severe, profound hearing loss who get cochlear implants. And so I don't see, you know, really waiting terribly long beyond the 12 month. If that's, I'm not sure in the UK, is it 12 months?
Yeah, or, 12 months in the UK. Yeah.
So I think those are some limitations. The other thing that, and it's an area that I always wanted to explore, and I've done a little bit of research, but you know, I don't know that we exactly know how to equate audibility with hearing aids and audibility with the cochlear implant. Mm-hmm. I think the comparison that I made in my study is still a valid one, in that we looked behaviorally at how the child was responding, you know, post-implant. And looked at audibility in that manner, but certainly electrical audibility and acoustic audibility are probably not the same. so those would be sort of the main things. The other piece, and I hope that I get to do this, but the other piece that that I really wanted to do was to finish filling in, if you will, the relationship and between audibility and canonical babble onset, because the children in my study were severe, profound, and you know, and really really more on the profound end. So even though I had a variation in audibility, I really would have enjoyed having children with milder, more moderate losses who would not be cochlear implant candidates, but that I could fill in the correlation between onset and audibility. So that's something that I still would like to do, and I think would be an easy enough thing to do. But that would sort of, you know, bridge the gap between the typical hearing speech intelligibility or audibility index of 1.0 and children who essentially had very limited audibility.
So scope. There's scope for other things here. So. Yeah. To kind of finish off the discussion, really. So in a nutshell, kind of big take-home messages for teachers of the deaf and possibly, you know, parents too, what would your big take-home messages be?
Audibility matters. Audibility is so important. And I think that, you know, as soon as a child is identified with hearing impairment, that provision of amplification right away is critical, even for children, and especially for all children that have, you know, the most profound losses. So do not underestimate what a hearing aid can do in terms of audibility for children who are implant candidates. There's quite a bit of audibility that's provided with the hearing aid, and it really seems to springboard the child forward in vocalization development post-implant, if that's the course. And for your students, it sounds like the majority of the studies are looking at children who are definitely pursuing the oral language. So I would say, you know, fight the urge to relax related to hearing aids once we have a cochlear implant on the horizon. Keep the hearing aids on. Encourage the parents to do so. I think, you know, oftentimes, you know, as clinicians, we can say, you know, keep those hearing aids on, but you know, you and I know that it's not always
not easy.
Children want to pull those hearing aids out just like they want to take shoes and socks off. And so, the consistency of parents and encouraging them and helping them to gain hearing aid compliance is critical. And that helps post-implant too, right? So if you develop those good patterns of device wearing with the hearing aid, it helps with compliance issues post-implant. Yeah. So it's something that the child is used to doing.
We talk a lot on the program about this, about supporting parents to even just practical ways of using the technology, of using the amplification, and also just broaching the times when parents actually find it very difficult to use the amplification for all kinds of kind of social and reasons that, you know, well, oh, we're going here today, they don't need to wear it today. Okay, right. So they don't wear it today, that means they're probably not going to wear it tomorrow either. And there's going to be another time next week and another time the week after when they also don't do that. So we spend so much time talking about that. And we have some pretty good mechanisms in the UK for supporting that, really, you know, that the use of amplification from the get-go, really. But, you know, it's only with really a lot of work that will become well established with parents. Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, I also wonder if you're, you know, I suspect that, you know, when audibility is emphasized, that, that audiologists, and they're keeping very close, track of real ear measures and verification measures. Yeah. And, you know, there was a period of time, I think, in the field, many, you know, years ago, that, there was maybe not as consistent use of verification measures for children. And I don't know, it would be interesting. I haven't looked lately to see if there have been any new sort of surveys. I would expect that verification measures are the standard, that, you know, a pediatric audiologist would no longer, you know, fit hearing aids without using real ear measures. But, you know, I think that would probably be the other piece, you know, as the provider, as the parent, making sure that that you have that piece during hearing aid fitting.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's been lovely to speak to you today. It's actually the first time that we've met. And so it's been incredibly exciting and a real honor and a privilege. And students, please go read the paper. There's lots to read in there, and lots of really interesting discussion that you can take forward, and then you're going to move forward to perhaps having a little bit of a discussion board about this particular paper. So thank you so much, Sandy. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.